Okay, I'll call the Subcommittee on Elections to order. We do have a quorum present, and I would like to ask Dr. Mann, Representative Mann, if you, I actually think doctors do. If you'd like to move the minutes?
Yes.
Okay, the minutes have been moved from February 20th. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Okay, the minutes have been approved. We are going to move to House File 1487, the Secretary of State's Office bill, and I am presenting it. So I will ask Vice Chair Bonner to take over the gavel.
Do we need to move the minutes first?
We just did. Oh.
That's right. Okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Representative Dean, for being here today. So the first bill that we have on the docket today for consideration is House File 1487. This bill was referred to the subcommittee by the chair, Representative Freiberg, of the full Committee of Government Operations. Representative Dean, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the bill and that it be re-referred to Government Operations, where we got it from.
Okay. Great. We have the bill before us. Representative Dean, please tell us about your bill.
Well, Madam Chair and members, this bill is actually similar to a bill that was moved last year with a few slight and I think ever so slight changes, maybe in some language, but clearly the majority of the things and changes suggested by the Secretary of State's office are included in it. And I'm happy to go through the whole all of the sections if members and the chair would like me to. I have a couple members from the Office of Secretary of State who will be here to assist us. Secretary Simon unfortunately can't be here right now. I guess he's on the side of a road with a flat tire, but he may be able to join us, but if he's encountering traffic like I encountered this morning, he may not get here before the time we finish. So there's a brief summary of the bill. Is Section 1 permits the office to prepare ballots for the statewide voter registration system for the participant and sending all corresponding material. Sections 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 17, 19, 20, 23, 24, 26, 38, 39, 40, 45, 47, and 50 upgrade language to say that it maintains residence rather than resides for clarification purposes. Section 3 and 4 clarifies that when a voter is registered to vote, they certify they have maintained residence at the address they are registered to vote at for at least 20 days preceding the election. And it also clarifies that a Minnesota driver's license, identification card, or last four digits of a voter's social security number are required to register to vote unless the voter has not been issued any of those. Section 7 provides a deadline for when county auditors must submit postal verification cards and reports to the Office of Secretary of State and clarifies that counties need to submit those postal verification card numbers related to the previous state general election. Section 12 conforms language to mirror the policy regarding the voter registration public information list and accepts AV list for those who have asked for their information be withheld for safety reasons and requires that this is withheld while AB applications are inspected. Sections 13 and 14 moves deadlines for county auditors to make absentee polling places designations from Subdivision 2 to Subdivision 1, update subdivision titles to reflect subdivision substance. These changes are only for clarification purposes. Section 15 conforms language to mirror the policy regarding the voter registration public information list and accepts AB lists for those who have asked that their information be withheld for safety reasons and requires that this is withheld while the names of voters who have submitted an absentee ballot that has not been accepted is inspected. Section 16 clarifies that if more than one voted, and voted being the key word here, ballot is enclosed in a ballot envelope that is spoiled and may not be counted, this ensures that presidential primary voters who return both presidential primary ballots with only one voted ballot do not have their voted ballot spoiled. Section 18 requires that UACAVA name, voters' name and addresses of the return envelope appear in substantially the same form as on the application record provided to the election judges by the county auditor. Section 21 adds language to give cities the option to require write-in candidates for local elected officials to file a formal request if they wish to have their write-in votes individually recorded. Also gives cities the ability to only tally write-in votes if the number is equal to or greater than the votes for a candidate listed on the ballot. Without this change, city election officials are required to take considerable time and resources to count and individually record write-in votes cast, many of those which are frivolous, example being Mickey Mouse or other types of write-in ballots. It also requires a write-in candidate for governor or lieutenant governor to file jointly with the person who seeks nomination as a candidate for the other office. And this would also apply to those running as write-in candidates for president and vice president. Section 22 amends language to say that a city or town only need to adopt an ordinance or resolution by the end of the year with polling place locations if the polling locations change from the previous year. Additionally, it corrects the omissions of the reference to counties in referencing other elections that may be held at a township polling location. Section 25 clarifies that write-in blanks are required for special elections. This was presumed based on reference statute, but now it specifies it. Section 27 clarifies the main election that main elections may include an office when an election has overlapping school and municipal jurisdictions, and one of the jurisdictions also has a question on the ballot. Section 28 requires that all polling places, regardless of the size of a town, city or town, must have voting hours starting at 7 a.m. for the state primary and the state general elections. This eliminates any confusion and gives voters equal opportunity and time to vote regardless of where they live. Section 29 conforms the language around county ballots at the end of the election to mirror the language for county ballots before opening a polling location, giving election judges the same authority that they have at the beginning of the day to assume that prepackaged ballots have the correct number of ballots in them. Section 30 reduces the number of summary tapes that must be provided to the county auditor from 2 to 1, as the state no longer requires a summary tape from each polling precinct be provided for the state canvas. Section 31 clarifies that a person receiving the highest number of votes for the office they are seeking is the candidate to be declared duly elected by the state canvassing board. Section 32 clarifies that the filing period for requesting a recount begins after the close of the canvas for that election. Section 33 clarifies the order of offices in the event there is a special election held on the date of a primary election, requiring that the vacant office being filled by a special election must be listed with other offices of the type but under any office of the type for which a candidate will be elected for a full term. Example being what happened last year where we had Senator Klobuchar and Senator Smith. Section 35 clarifies the order of offices in the event that there is a special election held on the date of a general election, requiring that the vacant office be filled by a special election must be listed with other offices of the type, but under any office of the type for which the candidate will be elected for a full term. Same example. Section 35 clarifies that the notice of contest for a special primary must be filled within 2 days after the canvass is completed. This is consistent with the notice period for a contest in a special election. Section 36 requires that a candidate filing for the office of the United States Senator to fill a vacancy at a special election when both offices of the U.S. State Senator are required to be placed on the ballot must specify on the affidavit of candidacy the expiration date of the term of which the office and which the office which the candidate is seeking. Section 37 specifies when the expiration date of a term of office shall be printed when the names of the candidates for both offices of the U.S. State Senator are required to be placed on the ballot. Sections 41 and Section 42 require escalation of the post-election review if the results of the electronic voting systems differ by more than 0.25% from the manual count of the offices reviewed. Section 43 clarifies the ballot title used in elections where both municipal and school district offices or questions appear on a ballot, and that this title not just limited to elections in odd number of years. Section 44 clarifies correct terminology when referring to the presidential primary example ballot. Section 46 clarifies the times that campaign insignia is prohibited at the polling place during voting hours. Section 48 clarifies that those elected at a special election shall take and subscribe the oath required by the law within 10 days after receiving a certificate or notice of election or appointment. Section 49 clarifies that all provisions of the Minnesota election laws are applicable to special elections as far as practical. And Section 51 repeals language authorizing towns with less than 500 inhabitants in unorganized territories to pick a later time for voting to begin in a state primary, special, or general election. And I'm going to take a drink now. of water, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dean. And while we give you a moment to take that in, I understand that you also have an amendment for us today. Would you like to move that amendment?
Madam Chair, I would actually like to move Amendment A1.
Wonderful. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? You should have that before you. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Can the bill author explain what the A1 amendment is so that members in the public know what we're looking at today?
Okay. Yep. Chair D.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm going to phone a friend. Julie Struthers from the Secretary of State's office.
If you could please state your name for the record and your office.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Struthers at the Office of the Secretary of State. This amendment primarily adds a requirement that there be a recount for a constitutional amendment if it's within the threshold for a recount for a statewide office. It also has some conforming language you'll see on 1.22 to 1.23 when we're talking about tightening the threshold for escalating those post-election reviews. It is we needed to change the 400 to 800 to reflect that we're going from 0.5% to 0.25% if we need to escalate a post-election review. And then the last section on page 2 addresses safe at home participants and how they would vote in the presidential nominating primary that we have coming up. They operate in a slightly unique circumstance where they are the only people who are true permanent absentee voters. They receive a ballot similar to how folks receive a mail ballot. They receive a ballot automatically every election, so they're not requesting a ballot. And so we needed language to accommodate the fact that they would be voting in the presidential nominating primary but wouldn't be requesting an absentee ballot, and it just wasn't addressed in the original presidential primary authorization language.
Thank you, Ms. Struthers. Chair Dean. Members, do we have any discussion on this amendment? Those in favor of the motion signifying by please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, the motion prevails. Those opposed.
We'll all say nay just so that we know.
We'll keep it moving. All right. Thank you for that correction. Representative Dean, please present your bill to the committee.
Well, we presented the bill, and I guess we would just move into questions now if Madam Chair would like to allow members to start asking.
Wonderful. Well, that motion did prevail, and then let's go ahead if there's any questions from the members for the testifiers.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a procedural question. Are you going to go with member questions, then public testimony, and then back to members, or are you just going to let members ask questions without the benefit of hearing from the public when they're making their decisions and asking their questions?
Yes. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Well, seeing none, then we will go ahead and move forward. We can go ahead with any questions then from members.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
To the bill author or to Ms. Struthers from the Secretary's office, I'm looking at the House summary, and perhaps the chair or the bill author or Ms. Struthers could go through and articulate which were the provisions from the bill last year from the Secretary of State's office, and then by default I would assume that the other ones would be the additional provisions, because I don't remember the bill last year having 50 sections. I remember having somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe a handful of sections, and so it's substantially different than it was last year, and I'm just wanting to get comfort with it since this is the first time I've really had a chance to work with the bill. So, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Chair Dean or Ms. Struthers?
Madam Chair, I will pass off to Ms. Struthers from the Secretary of State's office.
Madam Chair, Representative, in anticipation of that question, when Chair Dean was going through, I was trying to note the sections that are new. The largest piece that is new is the sections 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 17, 19, 20, 23, 24, 26, 38, 39, 40, 45, 47, and 50 are all clarifying the word resides to maintain residence. We define residence for the purposes of voting. And there was some confusion about sometimes we use the word reside, sometimes we use the word maintains residence, and so we're unifying that. But that adds a significant number of sections to the bill, even though it's making one clarifying change. The other sections are Section 1, which allows the Secretary of State's office to provide a ballot from the statewide voter registration system, and this is for safe at home participants. The way safe at home participants vote is through our office. And the practice right now is we request a copy of the ballot from the county. The county sends it to our office. We then package it, send it to a safe at home participant who then sends it back to our office, and then we send it back to the county for processing. This would allow us to use the copy of the ballot we have in the statewide voter registration system and get rid of at least that one first step of requesting a copy from the county. The ballot would still go back to the county for processing. But with the mail delays that we're having now, and with particularly some of these special election timelines, getting rid of even that one step will ensure that we're enfranchising more safe-at-home voters. Section 12 and 15 are new sections, and those deal with the policy regarding the public information list and those voters who have asked to have their name removed from the public information list for safety concerns. This also says that if you're inspecting like an accepted absentee ballot list, that their name wouldn't appear on that as well for the same policy reasons. It's those folks who have certified to us that they have a safety concern such that they don't want their name to be on the public information list. Section 18 is new. It's a clarifying change about a requirement that UOCAVA voters' names and addresses on the return envelope appear in substantially the same form as those on the application. I think that that was presumed, but it was not clarified in state law. Section 21, dealing with the write-in candidates, that was in the previous bill, but there's new language now that requires a write-in candidate filing for governor or for president have their lieutenant or vice presidential candidate file with them. We had an issue this past year where someone filed as a gubernatorial candidate as a write-in and listed someone as their lieutenant governor, and that person felt very uncomfortable being listed with the person who was filing for governor, and they wanted to have their name removed, and we didn't have any authority to remove their name, even though they did not want to be listed as a write-in candidate for lieutenant governor. So this mirrors the requirement for filing for governor. If you are filing as a traditional candidate, not a write-in candidate, you'd have to bring your lieutenant with you. Section 25 is new. It requires that there be write-in blanks for special elections. Again, that was always presumed, that, and we're clarifying that in law, that that's required. Section 28 is new, and we have talked to the townships about this. Right now, very few townships in the state are allowed to open later on a general election day starting at 10 a.m., and that has caused significant confusion with voters who are showing up at their polling place at 7 a.m. It's widely publicized. Voting starts at 7 a.m. They arrive and their polling place is closed. So we have had conversations about the townships about this. They still maintain that flexibility for every other election, just not a state general election or state primary election where everybody in the state is voting at the same time. Section 31, again, this is something that was presumed but is new. It is saying that the highest vote getter is the winner to be certified by the canvassing board. That, again, was always presumed, but there was nothing in state law that clarified that. So we're clarifying that now. Section 41 and 42 are new. Again, this goes to the escalation of the post-election review. This is where, in the post-election review, we're making sure that the tabulating equipment is functioning properly. And the threshold right now is, you know, we have an error rate of up to a half of 1% allows, and if it's over that, then there's an escalation. This would reduce that to a quarter of a percent, and that's because we've reduced the threshold for some recounts to a quarter of a percent, so it makes sense to reduce and essentially tighten the threshold to a quarter of a percent for the post-election machine reviews. And then finally, Section 46 clarifies the time that campaign or campaign insignia, essentially campaigning, can happen at a, or is prohibited at a polling place. We had some questions from particularly like the League of Women Voters or other organizations that want to do a town hall in a city, or yeah, town hall in like a city hall, right? And they want to do it after the city has closed and their absentee voting hours have ended. But they had a concern about bringing candidates in because the city hall is technically a polling place. And it's just clarifying that you can't have campaigning happening in the city hall during voting hours. But if it's after voting hours, if you're bringing in candidates for a forum, that's permissible. I will say this isn't addressing the more controversial issue that I think is in a separate bill regarding the Supreme Court case about what you can and cannot have in the polling place, the buttons and badges insignia. That is being addressed in a separate bill. This is just dealing with the timing around when electioneering can happen at something like a city hall. So those are the sections I pulled out. I may have missed one, and I'd be happy to follow up afterwards if I'm doing a direct comparison, but those are the big, not big, but the changes from the previous bill last year.
Thank you, Ms. Strother. Chair Dean. And I believe we do have a question from Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, Section 46, which deals with the solicitations near the polling places, what is the purpose of changing that language so that it's only during the voting hours and then people will be able to solicit from midnight to 7 a.m.?
Madam Chair, Representative, this goes to that issue of particularly like city halls, as public buildings that are used for absentee voting. And so they're technically a polling place during business hours, but in the evening, those buildings are often used for candidate forums. And there's been a concern by these nonpartisan groups that want to bring candidates in to talk about their campaigns, that could technically be in violation of the law because those buildings are a polling place. But they're not being operated as a polling place in those evening hours where they're bringing the candidates in. And so this is a clarification change that essentially you can't do any campaigning in the polling place when it's operating as a polling place. But in the evening or perhaps on the weekends, that building could be used. The example that's come to us most frequently is candidate forums.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mann. Ms. Struthers. And we have a question over here. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Dean, pleased to see your Section 31, lines 22.13 and 14 additions to the bill. Wondering if you could walk us through the changes that you're making there, and then we'll have some other questions as well.
Thank you, Representative Chair Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, you're referring to lines 22.13 and 22.14?
Madam Chair, yes.
I think that most of us operate from the point of view that the person that gets the most votes in an election is actually the person who should be declared the winner in an election. I think we've always operated from that, but evidently there are some areas of statute that it wasn't codified. So I think this just makes it real, 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 real clear within our statute that is who the canvassing board would certify as the winner.
Well, and Madam Chair, Chair Dean, thanks for your efforts to make sure that the top voter is declared the winner. I appreciate the effort. To another question, Madam Chair, in Section 42, line 27.4, subdivision 5 in Section 42, and this could be for Ms. Strother or for Chair Dean, you're lowering the percentage for review. Could you walk us through why that is?
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I will turn this over to Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, Representative, it sounds like we're lowering it, but we're actually tightening it. Right now, we're essentially saying right now under state law, the acceptable margin of error for voting equipment is 0.5%. And we're saying because that made sense when 0.5% was the standard across the board for a recount threshold. But now we're saying we want to narrow that because there are some recount thresholds that have a essentially smaller margin of error that we are saying is permissible. And because of that, we'd like to narrow that margin to 0.25%, saying that only 0.25% error would be acceptable. Anything above that would require an escalation, looking at more precincts and more equipment. And at this point, I might also just mention David Maeda, our new state elections director, is sitting next to me. He is an expert here on this, coming from the city of Minnetonka and also previously working in two counties in an elections function. And I would say that he's also a great resource if you have questions about anything in this bill or elections generally, and might be able to speak to that as well if you'd like.
Thank you, Ms. Struther. Mr. Maeda, would you like to state your name and your office for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Maeda. I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office.
All right. Mr. Maeda, do you have any comments on that you wanted to add?
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, I was actually the Hennepin County Election Supervisor when the post-election audit statute went into place, and we worked closely with a group called Citizens for Election Integrity that were really the ones pushing that we should do some type of audit. And what we have found over the years is our voting equipment is incredibly accurate. So this reducing or lowering the threshold, I don't think will really change what we've seen when we do these audits.
Thank you, Mr. Maeda. Representative Nash.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Maeda, or to any of the testifiers. The post-election audits, I know that those are often asked for by a number of different people. Where would someone go to find those?
Chair Dean, Ms. Struthers, or Mr. Maeda?
Chair and Representative, are you looking for the results of the post-election audits that are occurring?
Madam Chair, yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I believe we have the information on the results of the post-election audits centrally aggregated at our office, so you could ask our office, but those are conducted at the county level. And so you could also go directly to your county to see the more detailed information. We just centrally aggregate the results at our office.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you. And that's kind of one of the questions. I get a lot of emails. I think all of us get a lot of emails talking about post-election audits and where do we get them. And just wanted to make sure for the record that folks know that you essentially are a clearinghouse if folks wanted to get those. And how would they go about doing that? Would they put in a request, or how would that go down?
Chair Dean, Ms. Struthers, or Mr. Maeda?
Madam Chair, Representative, you'd have to just put in a data request. We have on our office, our website, if you search data requests, you'll get to a page with the process for requesting that, and we can see that information.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we also have a question from Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, a follow-up on the Nash question, but I'd like to also go back to Section 46, because I think that Representative Mann brought up an excellent point. And Section 46, again, deals with the locations that folks are going to be doing early absentee balloting. And Ms. Struthers, you indicated when you were talking about this that the League of Women Voters might be using City Hall for forms or other kinds of things, which got me to thinking that in the state of Minnesota, do we permit early voting polling places on locations that are other than government-owned locations?
Ms. Chair Dean, Ms. Struthers.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not believe that there's a prohibition on using a facility that's not a government facility. I would have to follow up and look at that. They have to be open the full 46 days. They have to meet ADA requirements. It's similar. The standards are the same for polling places generally, and we do have some polling places that operate out of churches. I would say, though, as a practical matter, almost, and we could pull the list, but I'm not aware of a permanent absentee location that is not in a government building of some sort, but I could look at that list and tell you. But they, and perhaps Mr. Maeda can clarify, correct me if I'm wrong, but they follow the same standards as polling places generally, and we do have polling places that are in churches and community centers that might be both public and private. But functionally, the absentee locations, because they're open for 46 days before the election, I can't think of one that's not a government building.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Struther. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. To a follow-up to that question, that was my concern, is that if we have it at locations that are not, that this is your examples and citing those were on publicly owned lands or properties. And I know that we've got schools, or there could be other locations in communities where it might be owned by a school but not being functioning as a school, but maybe used as other kinds of things. So you might want to address that language for clarification purposes so that we don't have any challenges in state statute on that or the like. And Madam Chair, my second section of questions, if I could.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes, I'm going to ask this of Mr. Maeda. Who canvasses township elections in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Maeda?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I would believe it would be the town board.
Madam Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
And I'll kind of speed it along. My question is schools, cities, and counties as well.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, for counties, it's the county board, and cities, it would be the city council. And schools, just obviously the school district board.
Madam Chair.
And Representative O'Driscoll.
So then we may also want to look at the bill then on pages 22.13 to 22.14. because it's giving right now the jurisdiction to the state canvassing board to take over county canvassing. So you may want to take a look at that.
Mr. Maeda, any comments on that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the intent was never to have the state canvassing board declare the winner for the local offices. This is dealing, I think, with just those that are addressed in the state canvass. But your point is well taken that I think we need to look at the language around county campuses, township school campuses, to make sure they have the same requirement that they certify the winner with the highest vote total. Your point is well taken there. We're addressing it here, but not necessarily other businesses.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No more questions at this time, Madam Chair. I'm sure I'll have a few more coming up here.
Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was actually one of my questions, so thank you for that. And Ms. Strother, you know, you had mentioned this language of maintained residence, and I'm wondering if you can just clarify for that for us and just give us the definition of that, because I don't see that in what we've got in front of us. And can you maybe go into a little bit more about what the confusion was with that and if there have been problems with that?
Thank you, Representative New. Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, I apologize. There is a statutory definition in our definitional section that I think has a 12-factor, not really test, but 12 factors to look at to determine what is a voter's residence. And the confusion came in particularly when the language said reside. We had snowbirds and college students who are saying, well, I'm not residing at my, you know, I'm not residing in Cologne, Minnesota, but that's my residence. You know, I'm in Florida right now. We want people to go back to that multi-factor test, which is, you know, if you're technically in Florida right now, but you haven't given up your residence in Minnesota, and that's where you intend to return, that can be your voting residence. So it is a 12-factor test. I apologize, I don't have the statute reference. It's in Chapter 200 off the top of my head. 201, I'm being corrected. I can get that for you, but it is designed to deal with that confusion in particular, the snowbirds and college.
Thank you, Mr. Strother. Representative New?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Strother. I appreciate that. Does that same definition apply to candidates filing for office as well?
Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe it does. It is so you don't lose your residence if you are undergoing home renovations and you move into an apartment temporarily with the intent to return. That residence 12-factor test, I believe, and I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, is what the court has looked at when they've determined whether or not a candidate is residing within the district.
All right. Thank you. Chair Dean, did you have a comment, please?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that our nonpartisan staff might be able to actually define this a little bit better. So if Mr. Gehring would be willing to address this and talk about it as well.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative New and Representative Dean, yet. So I'll just confirm what Ms. Strother said. So in Section 200.031 is a list of factors that are to be used to determine residence, and I do believe that it's been applied by the courts both to voters and to candidates. There's more case law on the candidate side of things to interpret whether a candidate has resided for the period of time necessary in a district to run for office, but it is based on the section of statute.
Thank you.
And as Ms. Strother said, it's actually a 13-factor list that you sort of balance to figure out where the person is living.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative New?
Thank you.
Okay. And do we have any other questions from members? And before we meet your question, Representative O'Driscoll, I do see that Secretary of State Steve Simon has been able to overcome his transportation challenges, so I would like to invite him down if he would like.
Thank you.
Welcome. Would you please state your name and office?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member Steve Simon, Secretary of State. I had a flat tire. And so the good folks at the Shell station off of the Riverside exit on 94 put the spare on, so I'm good to go. I understand that you've had the walkthrough now of the technical bill, but
yes.
I just want to say I'm here for questions, although I think you have more than you need on this bill from the people already here, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary of State. Representative O'Driscoll, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 44, we are striking the word sample and inserting the word example ballots. I was wondering if there's a clarification for the committee as to why that language is being chosen.
Chair Dean, Ms. Struthers?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is because it's actually we have a sample ballot and an example ballot, and this is where I'm gonna get them mixed up, which is the issue that is here. One of them is for voters, and there's a it is the sample ballot, I believe, for voters. David is nodding at me here, and then there's an example ballot that is sent to the counties for having them prepare their ballots. And the example ballot is essentially a ballot that our office provides that is annotated with the requirements under state law for what the ballot needs to look like. And as we drafted the presidential nominating primary language, we inserted the wrong language, sample versus example, in, and we want to clarify that.
Ms. Truther, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Truthers, so then the required publication notice, would that change as a result of the words sample and example? So a voter who would look at a ballot that might be in their newspaper or go to a website, is that going to change at all?
Ms. Truther.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, to my understanding, the presidential nominating primary is designed, except for where there is specified otherwise in state law, it would be conducted like any other election, which I don't have the presidential nominating primary language in front of me, but I don't think we made an exception for the sample ballot publication requirement. And I'm looking at the county folks to see if that is correct, but because we would have that requirement for any other election unless it was specifically accepted in the presidential nominating primary language, that standard state requirement would apply. And I don't think it was, but I might follow up with you to confirm that when I look at the presidential nominating primary language.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Truther.
Madam
Mr. O'Driscoll.
If we could just go back one more time to do the clarification on the ordering of candidates on the ballot, as it relates specifically to the U.S. Senate race. To my knowledge, we've only had two occurrences of that back in 1978 and then 2018, which there was a 30-year gap. Given the current landscape and incumbency of some of Minnesota's U.S. senators, are we anticipating that we're going to have a potential problem coming up in the future with this if certain election outcomes go in a particular way as some candidates seeking certain other offices might hope that they come to fruition? How's that for being specific but yet general?
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Ms. Truther?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe some of this is leftover language from the last technical bill that didn't become law, and that is when we were facing this issue where we had a special election for the two Senate seats, and we realized there wasn't specific language in state law for both how they would be ordered on the ballot, which race would go first, and language about when someone's filing an affidavit of candidacy. You know, they would say they're filing for U.S. Senate. Normally that is sufficient, but we didn't have the language that would require them to specify which Senate seat they were filing for. So while I guess I don't have any comment on predicting the future about whether or not we're going to encounter this issue again in the near future, this would solve and this would provide a clear direction in state statute for how those candidates should be ordered. We ordered them based on how other special election are treated in other offices down the ballot, but that is specified in state law in those sections about how to order them, and there was just a gap in state law when it came to the U.S. Senate seat.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Truther. Any other questions from the members? Representative Nash.
Thanks. Microphone. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Dean, Ms. Truther, or I think you called it phone-a-friend. Could you walk us through page 15, line 15.8 through 15.18,
on the new language you have in there regarding statutory or charter cities? That's not something I've seen before, so I figured it might be nice to get a little detail on that.
Chair Dean, Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm actually going to phone a friend here. This is language that was from the admin bill last year, if I'm reading the section right, regarding write-in candidates and how that is handled at the local level, the counting of them, and I might refer to Mr. Maiden.
Thank you, Mr. Maeda.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nash. This is currently for state and county races to count the write-in votes. The candidate has to file something with the appropriate election official, and then we count the write-in votes. This doesn't apply to cities. Cities have to count all write-in votes. Charter cities have the authority to mirror what the counties and state do for write-in. So some charter cities actually do what's in the bill here, but this would expand that to a statutory city. So if a candidate wanted their write-in votes counted by the election official, they'd have to file something in advance, similar to what's done with state and county races.
Thank you, Mr. Maeda. Representative Nash.
Nothing at this time.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've got a few questions just to clarify some language. On page 19, let's see here, lines 19.26 through 19.30, I just want to understand what we're trying to do here. I assume that this section is related to just questions on the ballot, not offices. That's how I'm reading it. In fact, it very specifically says no offices may be voted on in a mail election, where it seems that otherwise, if it's just a question, it could be a mail-only election. What is the goal here of this language, except in overlapping school and municipality jurisdictions where a mail election may include an office? Are we getting into a situation where then the office could be done exclusively by a mail ballot if it's crossing that jurisdiction, or would two ballots have to be printed? How would this work in practice?
Representative New, Chair Dean.
Madam Chair and Representative New, I think we'll also be able to have that discussion on the next bill that's up, but I will turn it over to Ms. Strother.
Ms.
Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, this came out of the issue, one of the benefits of having uniform election dates that was passed a couple of years ago is that we have uniform election dates. One of the challenges is we have, particularly for special elections, we have different election schemes that are allowed by different jurisdictions. And what we encountered was that we were having jurisdictions that wanted to conduct a special election on the same day, on one of the uniform dates. But they were operating under different rules about how to conduct the election. And the biggest example was some jurisdictions were allowed to conduct their election all by mail, and they wanted to. But an overlapping jurisdiction wouldn't have that same authority to conduct it all by mail. And so this resolves that issue of when you have two jurisdictions and they overlap either entirely in territory, but usually just in part, how you get uniformity across conducting the election. But it would allow, this provision would, if the two jurisdictions agree, allow a mail election to include an office if there is a mail election already being conducted on a question in an overlapping jurisdiction.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Ms. Strother, Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm sorry, but can you clarify that further? If it's overlapping jurisdictions, mm-hmm. and is this applying to if there is a candidate on the ballot as well, or is this still applying exclusively to a question that overlaps jurisdictions?
Representative New, Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, this could, if there is, for example, and I might have, if there's a representative from the cities or school districts here and want to correct me, but for example, if you had a school district question that was occurring on a special election day and the school district had made a decision to conduct that election by mail, And then a city had a special election for a candidate. And it was in either, you know, they could be entirely overlapping. The city could be subsumed by the school district. This wouldn't require that that city election be conducted by mail, but it would give them the option, if the mail election is already being conducted by the school district, to, they're going to have to decide one or the other. They can't do both. They can't operate a mail election at the same time as a in-person election. So either the school district would have to move to a in-person election and open up polling places, which they hadn't done previously, or the city would have to vote by mail. And then folks are nodding over there at my explanation, but the issue is giving them the flexibility to reconcile that the way that they choose, either moving, both jurisdictions would have to jointly agree to move all by mail, or jointly agree to open up polling places for the election. And it wasn't an issue that came up frequently when we had special elections that could occur any day throughout the year, but now that we have the uniform dates, it's been an issue that jurisdictions have encountered more frequently.
Ms. Strother, Representative New. Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you give me an example of where this has already been an issue? Representative New, Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'd have to get back to you on that. I know this came up, this was part of the bill last year, and we had a discussion last year with representatives from the cities and school districts, and I would have to get back to you on where it's come up and when. I know it was definitely raised as a concern, but I don't have an example off the top of my head.
Okay. Ms. Strother, Representative New. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that clarification. This just seems like a significant change to me as opposed to a technical change. So I hope that we can continue to look at that. My next question, really, let's see here. Let me just make sure I'm in the right place. So let me just clarify. Am I in the absentee ballot? I'm in the absentee balloting. That's the section on page 3. My question is, so this is specifically for absentee balloting, and on line 3.23 and down, it says, you know, the instructions must indicate that the voter must provide a valid Minnesota driver's license or identification card or the last four digits of a Social Security number, unless the voter does not have a Social Security number or Minnesota driver's license or identification card. What is the mechanism in place absent both those things?
Representative New, Ms. Strother?
Madam Chair, Representative, so there's a federal law that governs the documentation that is required to be provided by a voter. And it specifies driver's license number, Social Security number, or if they have neither, a voter is allowed to put none or check, essentially, I have neither. It's a very limited circumstance in which a voter would have neither of those documents. I think now that I forget when it happened, but at some point we started issuing Social Security numbers at birth, though that wasn't always the case, but it's in conformance with the federal law that requires that there be an option essentially to select neither if the voter attests that they have neither.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Strother. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's my understanding, and please correct me, oh, here we go. Well, it's my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that that for an absentee voter, they are required to provide that information as an absentee voter, even if they are a current registered voter. Is that correct?
Thank you, Representative New. Ms. Strother?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to pass it over to Mr. Maeda, who's been handling absentee voters directly more recently than us.
Thank you. Mr. Maeda.
So, Madam Chair, Representative New, to clarify what Julie just said, I was a Minnetonka City Clerk up until 4 weeks ago. So we handle absentee voting at City Hall. It is correct that on the absentee ballot application, the voter has to provide either the driver's license number or the last four of the social. However, it's not required that they do so. If they do not do so, it increases the chance we're going to reject the ballot, because if they have to, when they vote the absentee ballot, then they put it inside an envelope, and we're matching up the ID numbers on those. So it increases the chance that the absentee ballot would not be counted if they don't provide that.
And can you just clarify? Is that what we are looking at in subdivision two here, or is this I'm just a little unclear if this is how one requests an absentee ballot and votes absentee, or if this is simply the registration process.
Thank you, Representative New. Ms. Strother?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is the registration section, dealing with registration. Though similar numbers are dealt with in the absentee process.
Thank you, Mr. Other. Representative New, did you have a follow-up?
I do have a follow-up, sorry. my last question. On page 4, subdivision 3 at the top, deficient registration, it's just a little confusing because we're trying to define something by defining what it is not. So I just want to be clear, because there's a lot of ors here, and I want to understand what this means. So no voter registration application is deficient if it contains name, address, date of birth, current and valid driver's license, or state identification number. So that's one way in which it is not deficient. Or there's the last 4 digits of the Social Security number if they have one. So in the first scenario, it is all of those things, name, address, date of birth, driver's license, or state-issued ID. In the second scenario, it's just the last 4 digits of a Social Security number. That's all they actually need. Or in the third section, it's a valid Minnesota driver's license or identification card. Am I reading that correctly?
Representative New, Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, the intent here, and I agree with you that there are a lot of commas and Oxford commas and words here, is to say that you need the name, address, date of birth, and then you need a Minnesota valid driver's license with those things, or a Social Security number with those things, or if you certify that you have neither, and again, this goes to the federal law, that is sufficient, and it would not be deficient. And so I understand what we spend a lot of time on this language, and I agree that it is structured in a way that could be improved. And so I will take a look at that and see if there's another way to write it. But the intent is to say your registration is not deficient if you have those name, address, date of birth, plus a Social Security number or a driver's license, one of those two, plus state ID.
Yeah.
Or certifying, in this goes to the federal requirement, that you have not been issued.
Thank you, Mr. Heather. Representative New, just one quick reminder to members. We have about half an hour left on the clock and one bill left to go. Certainly, this is important testimony, so we don't want to do that. I do have 2 other folks on the list who want to do questions, but Representative New, if you want to go forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I appreciate that explanation. I think that is quite helpful, and perhaps we need some semicolons. I'm not sure exactly what we need to do to clean up that grammar, but the way it reads now, it's almost redundant with the Minnesota driver's license. It almost looks like that's a redundant issue. So, yeah, I would appreciate. I think that language does probably need to be cleaned up there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative New, anything further? Okay, good. Then we have Representative Nash next on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier or the author, sprinkled throughout the bill, there is a strike of the word resides, and now there's a new term of maintains resident. Can you walk us through that, how you arrived at that, and what it means? Oh, apparently I was coming back from the press conference when that was already asked, so I'll catch up with that later.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative O'Driscoll, I believe you had a question as well.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have just two other questions at this point. One, going back to Section 27 that Representative New had talked about, Statute 204B.46 with the election, mail elections question. Ms. Struthers, you had indicated that you didn't know for sure of where this might have happened. You're going to check with Representative New. Mm-hmm. A question I guess I have, and it is a real situation. In the city of Sartell, which is the largest city in the district that I represent, has three different school districts that are in that. And the city footprint does not completely encompass the entire district. So my question is it an all or nothing, or is this going to be mailed by precinct for those affected in the overlap?
Representative O'Driscoll, Ms. Struther?
Madam Chair, Representative, the intent is all or nothing. We don't have, other than a small piece of state statute that allows precincts that are incredibly small to be mail ballot, jurisdictions either make a choice about conducting an election by mail or opening up polling places. And there's, other than a small exception that allows for if there's a very small precinct with very few or zero voters, it's required that the jurisdiction conducting the election choose.
Okay. And Madam Chair, at the end, before we're done, I just have a procedural question. So at this point, I'll just defer.
Okay. Thank you. Members, is there any further discussion of the bill as amended? All right. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Dean, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that this bill be re-referred to government operations.
Okay.
And if I read Mr. O'Driscoll's comment, he would like to make a comment before we actually vote on this or no?
No. At the end of today.
Yeah. So I would make that recommendation and look forward to members supporting it.
Okay. Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 1487 as amended be recommended and be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Division.
Division. Okay. A division has been requested. All those in favor of the bill, please raise your hands. Okay. All those opposed? Okay. It looks like the ayes have it. Being four ayes and three nays, the motion prevails.
Madam Chair, question for you or for staff. If a member was absent when the initial vote that was division was called on was not in the room, how does that work?
Mr. Garrick? Okay, thank you, Mr. Gehrig. It looks like we can reconsider the motion and redo our vote since one of the members was not currently in the room.
So, Madam Chair, do we need to resolve that motion first, however?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That motion did not prevail, so we will redo the motion.
Mr. Gehring, Madam Chair, Mr. Gehring, does that reconsideration have to come from the prevailing side?
Madam Chair, I believe with the tie vote, there is no prevailing side.
Which means that, Madam Chair, which would mean that the prevailing side was it does not move forward.
All right, we're going to lay over the bill while our nonpartisan research gets some information on that so that we can move forward with Representative Hewitt's bill. All right, so next on the agenda is House File 677, Representative Hewitt.
Sugar. Thank you, Madam Chair. And real quickly, there were cupcakes at my house. My 15-year-old pulled them back, and he won't be going anywhere this weekend. So I brought the candy bag down if you guys want something. Sorry about that. But we want to go quickly here. So HF 677. This bill is a pretty simple, straightforward bill. Right now, the current statute sits where everybody outside the metro area that has less than a population of 400 can do mail votes. We want to change that, especially in my particular county, because many of these places under 400 right now, it's a big expense for our county. It's a big expense for all of your counties that are in the metro area. And that's what this bill basically does, is to change that so now we can take advantage of it. The carrier of this bill last time was actually Representative Garofalo. So I do have a testifier here from my county, and I would like him to take over the question.
I believe we have a procedural moment. Just to recommend, this bill, House File Number 677, was referred to the subcommittee by the chair before the full committee for government operations. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill to get it before the subcommittee?
Actually, I can't move it.
That's right. You need a member to move it.
Madam Chair, I would move Representative Hewitt's bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean. All right. Representative Hewitt, thank you for that. You said you have some testifiers for that. You want to tell us about your bill? And to the testifier, if you could state your name and your office, please.
Absolutely. My name is Andy Loken. I am the elections director for Dakota County. Good morning. Chair, members, my name is Andy Loken. I'm the elections director for Dakota County. I'm grateful to speak to this committee on behalf of Dakota County and the Minnesota Association of County Officers in support of House File 677. As the third largest county in the state, Dakota is home to over 260,000 registered voters who reside in 34 municipalities, 17 of which would be impacted by this legislation, which is obviously half of the total number of municipalities in the county. While there are some very large cities in Dakota County, Burnsville, Lakeville, South St. Paul, ones you may be more familiar with, there are also some very small ones, Hampton, Vermilion, New Trier. As the county, we support these cities and townships as much as we can. We train their election judges, we issue and count their absentee ballots, and we provide constant support. Still, much of the election effort falls on a part-time city clerk, and the municipal portion of the expense falls on a small population. One example of this is the voting system expense. In Dakota County, the municipal cost share of voting equipment is upwards of $6,000 per precinct. Beyond that, many more expenses are borne entirely by the municipality, since they have to provide a voting location, at least three election judges for each election, and other logistical support. These municipalities often conduct more elections than just the two state elections in the even-numbered year. They support townships conduct their elections in March. Cities fill vacancies with special elections, and state special elections are still conducted in every precinct. Beginning in 2016, Dakota County worked with three cities who were eligible under Minnesota Statute 204B.45 to authorize voting by mail, since the law currently allows any city, even in metropolitan counties, with fewer than 100 voters to authorize mail balloting. The cities of Coates, Neesville, and New Trier successfully implemented mail voting in their precincts and designated the County Administration Center in Hastings as their voting location. Voting's gone well, feedback remains positive, and voter turnout was not impacted negatively. By the way, the total voter registration of these three cities is 213. By amending Minnesota Statute 204B.45 to remove the language that excludes townships and cities with more than 100 voters in the metro area, the legislature would simply be providing metro area townships and small cities the same local option that is, as is provided to non-metro communities. As I've stated before, in Dakota County, this would allow 17 additional small cities and townships this option, affecting 14% of the county's precincts and about 4.5% of the voters. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Loken. Appreciate that. And do we have Kathy Sorensen in the audience? I'd like to welcome you down. My apologies. That's what I had on my note here. If you'd like to state your name for the record and your office, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Ann Lindstrom with the League of Minnesota Cities. Kathy Sorensen is the chair of our elections task force, and due to the weather, was unable to be here today. But I just wanted to take a minute to thank Representative Hewitt for carrying the bill, and thank you to MAKO and the counties for supporting it. As Mr. Loken said, there's not a lot of cities in the metro that would then be able to switch to mail balloting, but there's enough that it would really improve the efficiency of conducting mail balloting and the election for these cities. They would do so by passing a resolution, so that provides an opportunity for members of the public to be involved and say whether or not this is a way they would like the election to be conducted. And then the city does have to get approval from the county, because it's the county who would then conduct the mail balloting for the city that chose to do so. So I'm here if there are any questions, but thank you for hearing the bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lindstrom. All right. It looks like Representative Nash has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hewitt, thanks for carrying a bill that I was on last year. My county would benefit tremendously from this. I've got more than a large number of townships, and this would be a good option for them were they to choose to opt in. And I could do some freshman hazing and ask you to list those off, but I won't.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative Nash. Members, any additional? Oh, it looks like we have Secretary of State Steve Simon here who would like to comment. Welcome. If you want to state your name and your office, please.
Madam Chair and Member Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I just wanted to weigh in. Our office supports this bill to get rid of the restriction on metro area cities and townships. And I just wanted to foreshadow one other issue. It's not in this bill, so to some extent I'm hijacking this hearing. But to put on members' radar screen another related issues that I think that you'll see at some point in another bill. So the restriction remains at 400 for everyone. Let's talk about non-metro areas. It remains at 400. That law was put in place in the late 80s, so it's been here about 30 years. So the restriction is 400. So there are a lot of jurisdictions I hear from around the state, townships, well, cities in particular around the state, that would love to ditch their polling place because polling places are expensive, but they are too big to do that. I will give you the example of Carlstad, Minnesota. Carlstad is in Kitson County in the upper left-hand corner of Minnesota, and they would really like to do this, but they have about 418 registered voters. They're too big. So this cap hasn't been lifted in 30 years since the inception of this law. And I don't know what the magic number is. I'm happy to defer to the League of Minnesota Cities or to legislators who have an idea. I don't know what it should be. But 400 seems like it's a pretty low ceiling. And I'll give you an opposite problem that we're soon going to be facing. The city of Lutzen on the North Shore. The city of Lutzen is about to outgrow the reform that it has chosen. It, years ago, chose to vote only by mail, ditching its polling place because it had 200 or 300 some registered voters. If this law is not changed soon, Lutzen will become too big. They will be over 400 registered voters, and they will be forced to purchase elections equipment, have an ADA compliant polling place, hire election judges, and do all the expensive things that cities and jurisdictions must in order to put on elections. So for a variety of reasons, for pressure that's going both ways, cities that are currently too big and cities that are not currently too big but may soon grow out of the reform that they have adopted. I think it's time. I know this bill doesn't do that, but I think it's time that we raise that cap. I'm happy to defer to others in terms of what they think the cap should be, but 400 no longer seems to make sense in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. All right. Any other questions? All right. We do, it looks like, have one individual in the audience who would like to testify today. Do we have Ruth Simpson?
Actually, I wanted to speak on the previous bill. I had sent the note to the person to testify yesterday, but they did must not have received it. So I apologize.
Okay. Okay. Do we want to? If you want to hold off on that, we'll let you speak when we reconsider the bill. For the moment, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to Representative Hewitt's bill? Nope. Okay. Hearing none. Is there any other further discussion on this bill? No? Hearing no further discussion, Representative Hewitt, Chair Dean, would you like to renew your motion?
I renew my motion that this be referred to government operations.
Okay. Wonderful. Chair Dean renews his motion that House File 677 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay. It appears that the motion prevails. House File 677 is recommended to be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. So then we will have some unfinished business.
Thank you. And just to speak to the Secretary's numbers toward Dakota County alone, 14 out of 23 actually qualify in this new 400 thing. So okay. It's clear. And also, we didn't mention the town of Coates, which is the only one in my district. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Your bill is on its way. All right.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would make a motion to reconsider 1487.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Nash makes a motion to reconsider Bill 1487. And before we move into that, I do have Mr. Gary to explain from previously.
Madam Chair, members, so the process here, if the committee wishes to move House File 1487 forward, would be to adopt the motion to reconsider the previous motion where you voted not to move House File 1487 forward, and then after you voted on that and you've agreed to reconsider the motion, then you would vote a second time to refer the bill to the Government Operations Committee, if that's what you choose to do.
Okay. Then let's put before the members to reconsider Chair Dean's motion. All those in favor say aye.
Madam Chair, I think the first thing we need to do is, Madam Chair, is vote to reconsider.
Okay, vote. Do you want to?
Madam Chair, so the process here is the first motion is a vote to reconsider, which is the motion that Representative Nash made. A yes vote on the motion to reconsider would allow the committee to bring the bill back in front of it. So that would be the first step. And then the next step after that is a second vote to move the bill to another committee if the committee chooses to do that.
Okay. So first we'll vote on the motion to reconsider House File 1487. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Those opposed? Okay. That motion does, in fact, prevail. And I believe we have, before we can consider the motion, we do have one additional testifier. Apologize, Ms. Simpson, for missing you earlier. If you could please state your name and your office for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ruth Simpson. I am one of the staff attorneys for the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I apologize, I sent an email, but it must not have been received, that I wanted to speak today on the bill that you're referring, 1487. And there's two parts that I want to discuss. The first is the section, which is actually on pages 20 and the end, bottom of 20 and the bottom of 21, which repeal the allowance of townships to set different hours for their elections if they have less than 400 residents. And the appendix then includes the actual language. We represent, there's 1,781 townships around the state. We represent 1,779. I put together the list of townships, and there are 1,242 that fall under this 500 number. So if they are less than 500, they can set different hours. Most of them, as you know, are not in the metro area, although we do have several townships in the metro area. But this would affect a great number of our townships, and they feel very strongly. I have a resolution of a policy that the board has adopted, that they want to continue to have in-person voting, not just mail ballot voting, and this just moves it further. That more people may go that way, but they believe in in-person voting. They want to make sure that it's available. Having to have additional hours of operations for small areas of the state that don't have a lot of people is something that, you know, was agreed to many years ago. So we would like to keep that and not repeal those sections of the statute. And then the second part that I wanted to talk about deals with Section 22 and the designation of a polling place. And I do have handouts as well that someone would like to put them forward. There's been a lot of confusion about the polling place designation. And this was changed 2 years ago, and what happened is that they changed section subdivision 1 of Minnesota Statute 204B, but they didn't do anything with section subdivision 3, which basically I think creates at least a facial conflict for people who aren't familiar with, you know, looking at statutes, because that subdivision C, 3 says designation of a polling place pursuant to this section shall remain in effect until a different polling place is designated. However, Section 1 says you have to designate one every year by December 31st. So there's been some confusion in regards to that, and what happened was on the back I have a fact situation. One of our townships in southern Minnesota, in Fillmore County, they had been participating jointly and having a combined polling place with a small city and another township in the city, and then voted in the city of Fountain. The other two jurisdictions decided that they wanted to go to the mail ballot, which they can do. But the timing varies. So you have one statute. When you change, you don't want to go to a combined polling place anymore, you have an April 1st deadline. Well, that's after the December 31st deadline when you designate, you're supposed to designate your polling place. And then secondly, to do mail ballot, you just have to do it a certain time before the first election. And so it was May. That was in May. And so they made that designation. Again, these are all after the December 31st designation period. So what happened then is the town realized, well, we're going to be voting alone. But we would like to vote in our own township. and they found out they couldn't. They got different confusing messages, but essentially they said, well, your polling place had to be designated by December 31st, which means that you can't change it. So even though they alone, their own township, was voting in person, they could not vote in their own township. They had to go and vote in the city of Fountain. And so that was disturbing to them, and they wanted to see if there was a way to move forward so this wouldn't happen. And so looking at the statute, I think it's unclear, because the only exceptions provided in the statute are if there's an emergency situation, or the polling place becomes unavailable, or third, if a township designates one location other than for state and federal elections. And so it doesn't list an exception for changing combined polling. It doesn't limit, say, an exception for going to mail ballot voting in terms of changing your polling place if you designate it before December 31st. Now, either they need to include those exceptions, or are they actually using Section 3 then? Because Section 3 says it stays there, and then you can make a designation not less than 90 days. So I think it's confusing to people whether they need to designate and how they designate their polling place. And it also is also some confusion about when they pass this resolution, who does it go to? The statute does not say where it has to go to.
If I could, we are running late on time. If you could do us the favor of trying to wrap up your question.
So anyway, I have this in here. I apologize, Madam Chair. Just there's nothing that says that it has to go to a county auditor's office. So, you know, who's enforcing it? Why is the resolution being done? Anyway, we would prefer to go back to the original language that actually just says you have a polling place, but it stays there, and use Section 3 in the statute, because that's still in the statute.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Simpson, for your testimony. Chair Dean, would you like to comment?
Madam Chair, as the referral goes back to government operations, I hope there's an opportunity to sit down with the Secretary of State's office and figure out what exactly is the right language, so that we're not putting these townships or other places at in a hardship situation where they may not know exactly on December 31st where their polling place is, but create an exception or an exemption in the law for some other types of provisions. So that would be my recommendation relative to this.
Okay. Wonderful. Are there any questions from the members or any additional discussion on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, no further discussion. Chair Dean, would you like to renew your request and move House File 1487 to the Committee on Government Operations?
I would move that this be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
All right. Nice. Then we will go ahead and go to a vote. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? All right. And the motion prevails. House File 1487. As amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you. All right. Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a procedural thing. I don't know how you want to handle this, but you didn't move it as amended, and I'll let you figure out how to do that. It just was as. Now, we didn't have as amended. Listen to the tape, but okay. The other question that I have for Representative Dean is that, I may stand corrected. You didn't say that. He may have said that, so. But I know that I was listening to what the chair said, because that's usually what you ping off of, is what the chair says is the recommendation for the referral. But again, I just want to make sure you're covered on that. The other procedural question for Chair Dean, are we assembling and moving an election omnibus bill out of here, or is that going to happen in the government operations?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, we will be moving a government, omnibus bill that my understanding will not end up going to government operations. It will actually go to state government finance.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, will that originate here, though?
Yes.
Or is that going to be assembled in another committee?
No, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, we will be assembling it here, and we will be discussing it and moving it out of here to state government finance.
And thank you. My apologies. I did not mean to sound abrupt when I said that. I just want to make sure, since we had a procedural issue with it before, that we don't have an additional procedural issue. That's what I'm looking for. So thanks.
All right. It appears that they seem to be a consensus that we're good. Okay. All right. Thank you. Then we are. Okay. I just want to please remind the members of our committee meeting on Tuesday, March 5th at 8 a.m. We'll be hearing several bills that day, House File 1098, Representative Bernardi's bill, 1152, Freiberg, House File 1628 from Sandine, and House File 839 from Mr. Hewitt. All right, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.